Lamone Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Today is about listening. Listening to people driving action and change. Listening to people that can make all of that happen. Plus, how do you explain to kids what they've likely seen on TV the last few days? How protests and looting are not the same thing? Well, that explanation is informed by your perspective as a parent. We're going to have game plans to offer kids a roadmap to understanding. It's all ahead on Take Two.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
From 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Thank you very much for joining us. It really has been a very difficult weekend for most of us, so today we hope to bring some context to the story the best way we can, and that's by hearing from many different points of view. Protesters, police, store owners, mothers, members of our community, all that is coming up on the show. But now let's hear from some of the many who took to the streets over the weekend to protest the killing of George Floyd and shine a light on police violence and so much more.
George Floyd!
What are you doing?
Just out here for just peace, just justice, you know, just for George Floyd.
Take a knee and we'll leave right now. Come on.
Like, I don't know, you're just killing us. They try to say people have a chip, black people have a chip on their shoulder, but they're just really they're killing us slowly. In order to get peace, you have to go to war. You know what I mean? People go to war to get peace. You know what I mean?
People are tired. I'm tired. I'm tired of getting pulled over and getting treated disrespectfully. I'm tired of being abused by the police. I mean, you know, it's just, it needs to stop. If it isn't racism blatantly, what is it?
Shut it down!
What do you feel like the media gets wrong about these protests?
The perspective and what they choose to focus on, like there's so much, you know, emphasis on like quote-unquote rioting, quote-unquote looting. You know, we need to focus on the humanity of it. This guy right here, he's been standing here for I don't know how long, but he's got tears in his eyes, you know, frustrations and just like despair, right? We need to focus on that.
All right, so how do we understand the events of this weekend? What have we learned and how do we move forward from it? To start, let's hear from two young members of our black community in Los Angeles. Josh Hamm is founder of Healing Circle LA. That's a space where black men and women can decompress and talk about the issues in their daily lives. Fumiloa Fagbabila is one of the original members of Black Lives Matter. She's also a playwright. This is their perspective. Thank you very much for making time today.
Thank you. Absolutely.
All right, Josh, let's start with you. You were out protesting this weekend. You've seen a lot. You've heard a lot. For people who are trying to make sense of all of what they've seen, what was this weekend about for you and the people you were with?
Virtually, it was about, you know, getting justice for George Floyd. A lot of the people are upset and angry. People are getting tired of being pushed around, tired of seeing our people getting killed in front of us. On social media, some people are taking it as a joke.
Josh, you mentioned treating it as a joke. What part have you heard people thinking it's a joke?
I mean, while I was out there seeing police officers laughing at us, chuckling, especially white officers, of course, chuckling, laughing at the situation. I seen it was crisis actors out there, started a lot of the mischief, honestly. There's a lot of white folks out there doing what they're doing. And I seen a lot more of the black folks being peaceful rather than the white folks. And I think you got people out there. They say they're allies of black folks, but they're really stirring up stuff. And now they're portraying on media that people are, you know, thugs and we're just out there to loot and destroy stuff. When people were actually rallying and marching and had their signs up, it was peaceful. You know, when you're there and you know the truth, you know, the media always gonna make it seem like we just out there just to be out there. We angry for no reason, how they always do.
Fumiloa, you've been active for a long time in Southern California. What did you see play out here this weekend?
What I see being played out is a rebellion. I see the necessary articulation of a valid rage that can't be undermined as just some type of fleeting frustration. This is the result of hundreds of years of systemic oppression now being amplified by the most current events. and making it so that folks feel a different, deep and profound level of urgency to use their physical bodies or whatever means that they have to move and to make themselves available to lead us to some type of systemic change. And so I think that while so much of this is about justice for the brother George Floyd, that we haven't forgotten about all of the other extrajudicial killings, the senseless killings by the state, the people that are supposed to be protecting and serving, and all of the other systemic failures that make it so that people don't have access to the things that they need to survive and thrive.
Fumi Lola, why do you think it is difficult for some to separate rebellion, uprising with the word riot?
Because it is more convenient for those that don't really want to look at the reality of the systemic issue to just simply call it a riot, because it's easier to say that you're simply irrationally or violently reacting to one isolated incident rather than an uprising being a term that someone might use in reference to understanding the historical significance of an oppressive system that then leads a people to respond in the ways that they know how, right? And that leads a people to respond in a way where it's vocal and it is uncomfortable and it is present in a way that can't be ignored. So many of the people that are screaming for just peace, everybody just be peaceful, everybody, you know, don't be destructive. The systems that you're upholding are destructive. If you're not devoted to justice, then don't say anything about peace.
Josh, I want to get a little personal with you. You're 25 years old. You're from South Los Angeles. You hadn't been born when the Rodney King riots rocked L.A., and yet you have felt the reverberations. Tell me about the world that you grew up in and how that fueled your decision to protest this weekend.
Well, me being from the inner city, I had a couple of interactions with the police. A lot of them abuse their power. They criminalize you as soon as they stop you, ask you where you're going. They don't let you be in the area where it's a lot more white folks, ask you why you over here, what you doing over here. You know, like we can't have access to certain parts of the community. The education was trash. I always had white teachers that always felt like they was here to save us. My brother was in prison. So it was a lot of stuff I was faced with. You know, my community raised me virtually. And, you know, grace of God, I was in like after school programs and had a black man and woman to kind of help guide me and aid me. But I was in the streets doing a lot of things with my friends when I was there because I didn't have no support or no guidance. And I just seen a lot of the mistreatment in the community and a lack of access, especially when I went to other, you know, I guess you could say privileged communities and seen the access that kids had over there. I just think it's all set up. And I think we need to dismantle a lot of these systems because it's not benefiting none of us.
Fumi Lola, there were peaceful protests all around the country. But it seems like if you look at all the different websites and news sites, it's the destruction that seems to be on the front page. That's the pictures that you'll see, I think, the most. Is there any concern that the message gets lost or clouded in this gray of the way it's being covered?
Yes. I mean, it's deeply disappointing that the message would be lost. For those that are turning their attention to conversations about looting or destruction of property, I would ask those people, what is more important, a building or a life? What is more important, a building or hundreds of lives or thousands of lives that are lost by the hands of the state, by the hands of white supremacist violence, by the hands of poverty, by the hands of so many things that are preventable once we decide that they're preventable? And so I think that a great deal of the turning the attention, turning the lens to what's happening to property is a mechanism used in order to avoid the responsibility of the urgency of transforming the way that we deal with public safety and the allocation of resources in this society, which would help prevent a lot of the violence that we see. Because of course, another one of the things that people use to deflect from the reality of anti-Black state violence is, well, you know, what about all of these things that happen in inner city communities and what Black people are doing to each other and all of these other foolish diversions when they're not really looking at the systemic issues like poverty, like lack of access to resources that would actually lead to a decrease in violent crimes in all kinds of different communities, not just communities of color. But I will say one other thing as it pertains to media outlets and people and entities that are turning their attention to looting and not to the reality of people dying in all kinds of ridiculous, violent ways, systemically and historically, is there are going to be outside groups that come into these spaces for the sake of agitating, like Josh mentioned earlier in the conversation. And it is not some type of strange conspiracy theory to say that there can be agents brought into these communities that are sent there to begin the process of the destruction of certain buildings, the arson, all of these things. There's been footage from numerous different entities that have shown that it is not really Black folks protesting on the street oftentimes that are starting the destruction, but rather people that are unidentifiable and covered up that are coming in to start the destruction in order to help fuel the media narrative that these people are thugs, quote unquote, instead of oftentimes nonviolent protesters that are being met with force by police. And I've seen this with my own eyes.
Is there a way, Josh, to divide that line, to let people know that there is a difference between the two? And what's the effect of that cloudiness?
Now, to be clear, you got some folks that are angry and they may tear some things up. Of course, you got, like I said, you got some people that are MLKs and you got some people that are Malcolm X's. I mean, it's only, you can only push people so long until they eventually react. But what I've seen with my eyes going to these protests is that a lot of the Black folks want the peace. I've seen people throwing stuff and a lot of Black people are like, you know, don't do that, don't do that. You know, we out here trying to do the peaceful thing. But the police are still out there hitting people with their sticks, just standing there and shooting into the crowd with the beanbag. This girl got gashed in her head just being in the crowd. They just shooting at people. They more afraid and we just standing there. I feel like they weaponize our Blackness and they feel like they have a means to react and try to attack us. And it's tiresome. To the question, I think we have to put out our own stuff, our own media, and report back to our communities and talk to our people and put our stuff on our Instagram and have our own outlets and say what we've seen on the ground. And don't let these white people report back for us because they're going to misconstrue it. I was watching the news last night and it was so annoying. It was just like, this is not how y'all celebrate George Floyd or whatever like that. But it's like, bro, people, we're not even the ones out there starting this stuff. I literally seen white folks throwing stuff at police. Hitting stuff, breaking windows, like with my own eyes. And I'm just like, wow, this is not what we're out here for, bro.
We're talking to Josh Hamm, founder of Healing Circle LA. Fumilola Fagbamila is one of the original members of Black Lives Matter. Fumilola, Barack Obama weighed in on the events of this weekend earlier, and he said, quote, if we want to bring about real change, then the choice isn't between protest and politics. We have to do both. He then outlines changes that can be made to policing as well as the criminal justice system. As an organizer, how are you planning to take this raw emotion and channel it into something that brings lasting change?
Well, you know, I will say this. We cannot forget about the fact that it is under Obama's administration that the Black Lives Matter movement began. It is under Barack Obama's administration that you have the incidents with Philando Castile and Alton Sterling and Mike Brown, and the list goes on, and Trayvon Martin. So I don't want to hyper romanticize it as if, you know, a few years ago, we were in a good place and now we're in a bad place. This has been longstanding. But I will say that as somebody who advocates for all human beings having access to what they need and for Black people getting equal access to justice in this land, my first initial thought around this, how to make this something that could potentially be lasting change, is that people, number one, decide to care about this after the sensationalism is gone, after the dust settles, after the media no longer runs the story about it, after everybody goes back into their houses and off the street, how will you decide to make it so that you have devoted some amount of time, attention, and energy to combating a system that dehumanizes Black people specifically? Right. That how are we going to make this something that we incorporate into our lives after we no longer are a part of the resistance, right? Because the rebellion is what's taking place right now. The revolution is what happens when a people decide to devote themselves to the transformation of systems. Because a lot of people are saying, oh, we're in the middle of a revolution right now, that we are revolutionizing the system because we are changing it. No, you are rebelling against it. What happens when you decide to make this a longstanding, devoted project, where you decide that we are going to do whatever is necessary to transform systems, is when we're talking about the potential of a revolutionary outcome once a people decide to devote themselves for the long term to the transformation of a system.
That level of care, where it's something that's important past this weekend, past, say, even a week or a month from now, where it's something that's a part of your life, a component of your life. How do you know that that has become something that you care enough about to follow it through.
Because you take what you know how to do well and you devote it to helping with the transformation of violent systems. Whether you're Black, whether you're white, whether you're a brown person, and you know whatever you know how to do well, you say, I will offer that. I will lend that to the movement to combat police repression, to combat anti-state violence, and to combat any types of repression that exists under the current regime. That is what I believe, is that we take what we know how to do and we offer it in service to the resistance. A lot of times people think that they're gonna have to give up their joy and their peace and their happiness in order to do that. No, what you might have to do is give up some of your comfort. You might have to have difficult conversations. You might have to be unlikable for a moment. You might have to go off brand. You might have to say something that doesn't feel congruent with your brand, right? But we are in that moment now where people have to step out of the urgency of likability and step into the urgency of transforming the systems that kill us and that harm us. Devote yourself beyond the end of the sensationalism. And we can see what a revolution could potentially look like as opposed to just a temporary rebellion.
Fumilola Fagbamila is one of the original members of Black Lives Matter. Josh Hamm is the founder of Healing Circle LA. My thanks to you both for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, whether they wanted to or not, many small business owners were pulled into the events of the past few days. They were either standing in front of their stores hoping to protect as much as they could, or in some cases showed up after the fact to assess the damage. Thing is, they all share one big question, and that's now what? Coming up, we'll hear how they're processing the state of their businesses after the weekend with the pandemic still hanging over all of it. That's next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win, and the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
A boy is born in hot damn Mississippi, surrounded by for one that ain't so pretty. His parents give him love and affection to keep him strong, moving in the right direction, living just enough for the city.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm Ian Martinez. Los Angeles County has once again enacted a curfew tonight that goes into effect at 6 p.m. and will last through 6 a.m. tomorrow morning, with the possibility for extension. The public is not allowed on the streets, parks, or other public areas. And the curfew comes on after a weekend of peaceful protests turned to chaos over the weekend all over our area. And with that, small businesses and large ones, actually, were paying the price. Miles Guyden co-owns Hollywood 3D Printing, located on Melrose, with his brother Philip. When we spoke with him, he detailed his tense Saturday night spent in front of his computer refreshing his wireless camera feed.
Every 2 minutes, I was refreshing it, and hopefully I would keep seeing two windows and one door. And then at about 11:30, I saw one window and one door and people coming through the open spot. And that's when I got on the phone with my brother, and I was a couple hours away. And so I got back on the road and ended up getting back to L.A. at about 4 in the morning on Sunday morning. And as soon as the curfew was lifted at 5:30, got back in my car. I live about 5 or 10 minutes from the shop, so went in and started boarding it up. Certainly no problem with protesting, no problem with peaceful gathering of people who, you know, speak their minds. That's a good thing. And when it turns violent, you know, I understand why. I think everybody really understands why. Doesn't mean it's okay. Doesn't mean it's good. Certainly not okay. But I'm critical of the looting, and I'm critical of the tagging and the graffiti and you know, all the damage and chaos. That's something that, you know, can really never be condoned. Luckily, the damage and the theft from the business was surrounding personal property and items in the business, which were used as like display pieces or samples. So I think the rioting and the looting, as long as it doesn't come back and continue in our area, luckily our business will recover pretty quickly.
We closed early yesterday when we saw the protesters coming down the street. We've just reopened 3 days before. So we closed down, and then I'm assuming at some point in the night, they broke our windows and put graffiti. I'm very thankful because it's just a broken window and graffiti, and that can all be fixed. Some people had much more damage and lost a lot of inventory, and we did not, thankfully. And more importantly, the conflict is damage versus the cause, and I just fear that all the looting and damage that's being caused is taking attention away from the important cause. And that's why a broken window and graffiti isn't a concern to me. The concern is this cause, which is incredibly important to me.
We're in Santa Monica 4th Street, and I have a store here. It's called Yak Exchange. We've been trying to move all the jewelries. We're trying to move everything in the car so that way they can't break into it. Thank God they didn't break our store yet. But I'm still worried in the night they might break into it. I'm with the protesters, but there are a lot of other bad people. They're trying to loot, which is not good. They're hurting all the businesses. It's not good. They're scaring everyone. It's not good. This store, we were here for 6 years. So now we are planning to close down. I don't think it's safe to be here anymore. I'm thinking they might do it every, for a couple of days.
That was Pasong Lamo, owner of Yak Exchange in Santa Monica, Laura Armstrong, owner of Ampersand Boutique in the Fairfax District, and Miles Guyden, co-owner of Hollywood 3D Printing, also in the Fairfax District. Now, for more on businesses that have been affected, we have KPCC reporter Emily Guerin. Emily went out in Santa Monica this morning and spoke to some business owners. She joins us now to tell us what the scene is like out there. Emily, welcome back.
Thanks, A.
Now, you set off this morning down Lincoln Corridor in Santa Monica, just south of the 10. As you made your way into downtown and Santa Monica proper, how have businesses been affected? What did you see?
So on Lincoln, which is just outside of downtown, there was still a fair amount of damage. Some stores had their windows broken. Others had their inventory taken. The first business I talked to was a Cricket Mobile store, and the manager there said he sent his employees home early and then watched, as one of the previous business owners said, sort of on the surveillance camera as people came in and stole things. In the downtown area, it was more concentrated, I would say, the vandalism and the looting, but it did seem like it spread a little bit out of the core downtown, both east and south, as the afternoon progressed and turned into evening.
Was there much of a difference between the bigger chain stores and independent stores affected?
You know, I was thinking about that. I don't think so. The biggest difference I saw was that business owners who stayed behind were able to more or less defend their stores. And it seemed like small independent businesses, their owners or employees were the ones staying behind. I didn't see people yesterday. I didn't see employees of any of the larger retail stores defending those stores. But I did see a number of small business owners, including that the woman you just heard from, yeah. Who owns the Tibetan Exchange, who were there and described sort of begging with people not to break into their store with various varying degrees of success. Like I said, most people that stayed behind seemed to be able to prevent damage. I did talk to one employee who said she was there and people went in anyway and, you know, broke things and stole items.
So you spoke to a few business owners who were affected. What did they say? How are they dealing with the aftermath?
Well, One man I talked to, he owns a jewelry store on 4th Street. He seemed to be a little bit in shock when I was talking to him. I mean, it was sort of a chaotic scene. There's like people everywhere with brooms and brushes and cleaning up spray paint. Everyone's asking him if he needs help. There was an insurance adjuster there talking to him about making a claim. There were TV crews there. And he was saying basically that he feels like he was totally devastated. He was actually there for much of yesterday and then left. He said it was really scary. He said he feared for his life and he left. He hopes to reopen. I think some of the other smaller businesses that are maybe have a little bit less sort of runway and cash, it was more of a hit to them and they aren't sure if they're going to be able to reopen, or they felt particularly set back by coronavirus shutdowns, lockdowns, and are just not sure how to go forward.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you about that, because we know that a lot of small businesses all over, not just Southern California, but all over the country, are hanging on by their fingertips because of coronavirus. I'm wondering how much more of an added blow could this have been?
Well, I mean, so this the woman who ran the Tibetan import store that we just heard from, I went today to try to find her, and they were gone. And I talked to one of the neighbors who owns a bike rental store, and they said they heard that they had just closed up completely and were going out of business. I need to confirm that with them. But that was the sense she was giving me yesterday, was just that it was just too much. You know, Santa Monica obviously is a very high rent district. And maybe the combination of the sort of stay at home orders plus the vandalism and the looting yesterday was overwhelming for them. I will say, though, most business owners I talked to were like very empathetic towards Black Lives Matter, towards the cause of police brutality, felt very supportive of, you know, the people protesting George Floyd's death in Minneapolis. And they were upset that so many independent businesses had been targeted by looters. But they understood that those were different, sort of different things that were happened to be happening at the same time in the same area.
Emily Guerin's a reporter with KPCC. She spoke with business owners today in the Santa Monica area. Emily, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
Protests against police violence and the damage caused by looters swept across all of Southern California. Right now, we're going to take a look at how they transpired in Orange County. And with us to do it, as we do every week, we have Nick Gerda from the nonprofit news organization, The Voice of OC. Nick, welcome back.
Hey, A, great to be here.
A lot of the attention, Nick, has been placed on L.A., Santa Monica, and Long Beach. But how many protests took place in Orange County over the weekend, and where were they?
Yeah, there were at least five across Orange County in various cities. They began on Saturday in Orange, Fullerton, and later Santa Ana, where things intensified as the night went on, and tear gas was fired by police and rubber bullets at a subset of protesters who were launching bottles and firecrackers at the officers. But ultimately, the vast majority of protesters were peaceful in Santa Ana and the other Orange County cities. Also, protests were in San Clemente, Huntington Beach, and other cities. Ultimately, about 17 arrests in Huntington Beach out of 500 protesters, and two arrests in Santa Ana out of 1,500 protesters last night. And people were out denouncing police violence, calling for police accountability, chanting Black Lives Matter, and really joining the nationwide movement along those fronts.
Well, you mentioned Huntington Beach, Nick, because what went down there is making national headlines. So yesterday afternoon, the protests there were declared an unlawful assembly by authorities. But some were pointing out, especially all over social media, that protests a month ago against stay-at-home orders were not considered unlawful assembly. So what can you tell us about that?
Right. So both of these protests, both the anti-stay-at-home order protests about a month ago and the protests for Black Lives Matter yesterday, they're right along PCH in front of the Huntington Beach Pier is where they were at. Now, the protest a month ago against the stay-at-home orders was not declared unlawful by police at the time. We didn't hear any reports from police citing violence at those protests a month ago. Yesterday, they did declare the protests unlawful after counter-protesters showed up and confronted the demonstrators who were demanding justice for George Floyd's killing. Police ended up shutting down the protests just as counter-protesters were gathering, which triggered some escalating tension between the two groups.
And we reached out to the mayor of Huntington Beach to explain that disparity and how the city responded, but we have not heard back yet. But Nick, is the sense that because counter-protesters showed up, that's why it had to be kind of labeled as unlawful?
Well, I think that in and of itself may not have done it, but okay. I think the dynamic intensified once that happened. And what the police department has said is, in defending their decision to declare it unlawful, they said there was violence in the area, like assaults, blocking of traffic on PCH, and they claimed that protesters were carrying weapons like pepper spray and what they called impact weapons, which wasn't really defined. But they said they found cinder blocks and rocks in an alleyway. As far as I know, they haven't released pictures of that or confirmed that was actually placed there to cause violence. But these are the kinds of things that they're citing is the risk and potential weapons that could be used in violence.
Talking to Nick Gerter, reporter for the nonprofit news company, The Voice of OC. Nick, all right, now to Santa Ana. What happened in Santa Ana?
Yeah, so things started intensifying in Santa Ana on Saturday night when a group of protesters started launching bottles and firecrackers at officers, and officers, you know, came back with tear gas and rubber bullets. But most vast majority of the protesters were peaceful. After things died down a bit, there was some looting in Santa Ana near where the protest was happening, of a Smart and Final store and other stores next to the protest. A lot of the community in Santa Ana was very troubled to see that. And the next morning, dozens, if not hundreds, of people came out to clean up and really come together as a community. Both Republican and Democrat city leaders came out to stand up for the community and clean up the damage that was done. And then and yesterday in Santa Ana, about 1,500 protesters gathered at the old Orange County Courthouse and separated into different groups, going through different parts of the city, and were largely peaceful. Out of that group of 1,500, there were two arrests.
What's the history in Santa Ana driving some of the tensions with police?
Yeah, so Santa Ana has a long history of tension there. There's been a long amount of distrust among local activists towards the police, stemming from police beatings, including the Edgar Vargas beating in 2014, which was caught on video. That was an undocumented man who had put his hands on his head, laid on the ground, and an officer started punching him. And that officer was actually later charged by federal prosecutors, I believe, last year, about 5 years later. And then the city council's decisions have also drawn a lot of tension over their choices to keep building a larger and larger share of the city budget towards the police department, including a vote last year for $25 million in raises for police over the next 3 years, at a time when the city has been having financial struggles. And in fact, right now, the city's projecting major budget deficits going into the future. So a lot of questions about how the city prioritizes public safety between law enforcement and things like libraries, after-school programs, and education.
Yeah, I know the city also imposed curfews overnight. What's been the reaction there to those curfews?
Yeah, there's been some concern from local activists that this would exacerbate the divide between them and officials. They're saying that officials are focusing more on curfews instead of addressing the underlying frustrations about underfunding parks, libraries, et cetera. The city, meanwhile, says it's a prudent step to have curfews to protect public safety, given the looting and the unrest on Saturday night.
I know there's a scheduled protest tonight in Anaheim. What can you tell us about that one, Nick?
Yeah, we know there's going to be another protest in Anaheim and in Costa Mesa. A lot of eyes on those and seeing what will happen. As far as we know right now, Anaheim has not imposed a curfew in their city, but given the trend in the last day or so, it's not out of the question that they might do such a curfew, and we'll have to wait and see what happens there and in Costa Mesa.
All right, that's Nick Gerter, reporter for the nonprofit news company, The Voice of OC. Nick, as always, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right, one of the things we saw yesterday were police, local police, in military-style equipment. We saw it all over Santa Monica. We also saw it in downtown L.A. as well. But one of the things we also saw was actual military, the National Guard, out in force, out backing up local police. We're going to talk to KPCC's Frank Stoltz coming up in just a bit to get into, number one, how police tactics have evolved, say, since 1992, and how they're being applied today, considering everything we've seen all over the country. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
Black people have protested peacefully, and Black people have burned it down. And in the end, the cycle of police violence, it all remains largely unchanged.
I'm Michael Barbaro. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Now on weekdays at 3:30 on 89.3 KPCC.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiot's and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm Ian Martinez. Police and the National Guard are out in force again today in an effort to stop any looting. The weekend saw mostly peaceful protests, but also widespread disorder in Los Angeles. And now for a closer look at some of the police tactics, we turn now to KPCC's Frank Stoltz. Frank, welcome back.
Hey.
First off, a lot of people are questioning police tactics over the last few days, with some saying that police may have been heavy-handed. Were police heavy-handed?
Yeah, this question focuses a lot on the use of tear gas and rubber bullets after main protests were over and some people were still blocking streets in Santa Monica or Long Beach or LA. We've heard numerous people say that they were still peacefully protesting in the streets and that they were hit by either the gas or by these rubber bullets. The key for police, A, is that there may be some people who are peaceful while others are engaging in unlawful acts like looting or even setting fires, and that those two groups can get mixed up together. Here's LAPD Chief Michael Moore to explain a little more.
When law enforcement determines a situation is unsafe, endangers the lives of people who may have absolutely no idea that they're about to die, that we have the authority to close that area, and the participant, the person in that group, has a responsibility to leave.
So you hear the dramatic language, yeah, of people about to die, and that's why they're asking people to leave, and whether or not you're one of the people who could be violating the law or just a peaceful protester, you still have to go. So here the main question is the dispersal order. And it appeared to me that at times dispersal orders may have been issued and that some people may not have heard them, or the order was issued in one area and police were enforcing it in another down the street or around the corner. So that could be problematic. Mm-hmm. The curfews also changed everything. After curfews were issued, police, of course, didn't need a dispersal order. Yeah. I saw this firsthand, when the LAPD trapped about 30 cars along a block of 8th Street downtown. They were caught in a traffic jam, basically. Some occupants had participated in looting, and the LAPD detained all of them and towed all of their cars. One guy told me he hadn't looted at all, that he was merely caught in the traffic jam, but he was out after a curfew, so he was still subject to detention and arrest. So he's stuck with an arrest record now and a $200-$300 charge to just get his car out of the police yard. And he feels like he got a raw deal.
Wow. And we should say there is a curfew tonight in L.A. County at 6 o'clock, just so everyone understands that. Now, what about de-escalation? A lot of people accuse the police of escalating instead of de-escalating.
Yeah, police deny that. And I should note, some police departments are better at de-escalation than others. Police talk about or people talk about the police. But in fact, different police agencies can have very different policies and practices. The LAPD, for example, you know, was under that federal consent decree for nearly a decade that forced it to change its use of force policies to better track problem officers who might escalate situations. And the LAPD totally revamped its crowd control training after its riot police beat immigrant rights demonstrators in MacArthur Park more than a decade ago. Then more recently, the police commission enacted a series of reforms. So no other department in the region has undergone such change, not Long Beach, not Santa Monica, not the sheriff's department. So, A, you could get very different interactions with police across the region. You know, I should note, though, that the sight of heavily armed, helmeted police, some with military equipment, whether it's LAPD or Santa Monica or anywhere, can be a really imposing sight, particularly if you're up close. And it can really, you know, raise tensions. Black Lives Matter points out that LAPD is among the top departments in the nation involved in shootings in raw numbers, use of force shootings. That's obviously the issue here when it comes to George Floyd, the use of force. And I'll just note that so far this year, LAPD has shot 20 people. Last year, they shot 36. The year before that, 39. So I'm pointing those numbers out because we can't lose sight of the real issue here, which is police use of force.
Now, when it comes to the presence of the National Guard, do we know what kind of effect it's had since they've been here?
Well, it seems to have deterred the violence. The guard arrived in the middle of the night, Sunday, then and into L.A. and then went to Santa Monica, Long Beach yesterday. And it seems to have reduced some of the violence. I did witness a standoff between the guard and protesters yesterday outside L.A. City Hall that appeared less tense than some of those that I've seen with the LAPD. The protesters actually saying, hey, our beef is not with you, to the National Guard. It's with police.
And Frank, if people were hearing our coverage yesterday, and you mentioned rubber bullets earlier, we have the story of our own Adolfo Guzman Lopez. Remind us what happened yesterday with him.
Yeah, Adolfo says he was off to the side of a protest in Long Beach yesterday, interviewing someone with his iPhone, wearing his journalist ID on a lanyard around his neck. He says when he finished the interview, a Long Beach officer shot him in the neck with a rubber bullet. He's okay. It left a very nasty mark. Earlier today, about 2 hours ago, Long Beach Mayor Robert Garcia mentioned the incident.
I personally reached out to Adolfo last night. We communicated over messaging today. I have apologized to him for what happened to him.
Interestingly, Long Beach Police Chief Robert Luna was not ready to admit wrongdoing on the part of his officer.
Yes, we have a version of what happened, but being in this business for 34 years, there's always two sides to every story.
So, we'll certainly keep you updated on that investigation.
All right, that's KPCC criminal justice correspondent Frank Stoltz. Frank, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Ed.
After the chaos of the night on Saturday and Sunday, people all over the LA area came out in the morning to help clean up. Here are some of those voices.
We're cleaning the area that was destroyed by the riots last night, or the looting, excuse me. So this is what Long Beach is about, coming together, regardless of it's black, brown, whatever the affiliation is, we're here together and we're here building it up back again.
What are you doing here?
Cleaning up after the mess.
So tell me what brought you up here today.
Just watching my town get thrashed. I mean, we're going to look back at this. This is not how we want to be remembered. It really breaks my heart, honestly.
Are you guys California Army National Guard?
Yes, ma'am.
Great. What time did you guys come out here?
Pretty late at night we got here, been here all day.
You didn't get any sleep?
Not really.
And what did you see last night?
Complete mayhem. People coming into the parking lot, setting off M-80s. Saw them going into the CVS. I called the fire department as soon as I saw the smoke.
This is the CVS store near 6th and Pine. Right now you can see where the security bars have been pried open, the front windows and side windows broken. They're now boarded over. And you can still hear the sound of a fire alarm going off inside. Let me see if I can get a little bit of that.
Are you in a particular group?
No, I just live downtown and want to take care of my neighborhood.
We heard from several individuals who volunteered to clean up debris from the looting this weekend. Jacob Quintana, Lisa Hoyle, John Matarazzo, and Sergeant Watson from the National Guard. All right, more Take Two coming up in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Harole is your connection to Los Angeles. Get to know its history.
The 1920s were a huge boom time in Los Angeles, and downtown was just exploding.
Its politics.
It's the biggest local prosecutor's office in the country.
And its food.
Korean spices with like a hint of sweetness.
And just everything we love about L.A., Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
Ever since.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and also streaming on the KPCC app. I'm Ian Martinez. The events of this weekend, first the protests and then the violence and vandalism that followed, are a lot to process for anyone, much less a child. How to explain what's happening and why? The conversations are different, though, depending on the race of the family. Joining us to discuss this is Amber Coleman-Mortley. She's the director of social engagement at iCivics, the nonprofit started by former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor to promote civic engagement among children and educators. Amber is also an expert with the NBC News Project Parent Toolkit. She's also a mother and a podcaster. Amber, thanks for joining us on Take Two.
Awesome. Thank you so very much for having me. It is a pleasure. I can't wait.
Sure. Now, Amber, you have three kids, 12, 11, 9?
Yep. Three championships back to back.
So wondering, though, Amber, what kind of conversations have you had with your kids this weekend?
So we've talked a bit about George Floyd. We talked a bit. Last night we went on Snapchat and looked at Snap stories from what's happening on the ground with protesters who are on Snapchat across the country. We always have conversations about race because our identity is an important part of who we are. We can't get around that, right? Like, we can't not be ourselves. And so, you know, a lot of times there are situations and scenarios that, you know, people are like, oh, that's not even related to race, but for us, it actually is.
Now, on this note, you and your kids recently started a podcast where you talk about a lot of different stuff. I want to play a portion recorded weeks ago about the shooting death of Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia.
I have a question. You know, people might say, oh, why is she talking to her kids about, you know, a black man who was slain while running, right? Like, that's an inappropriate topic for discussion. Are kids able to talk about stuff like this? Like, what do you think?
Actually, you'd be surprised because sometimes, like, if something happens, like, maybe your kids are could be the only ones you could talk to.
Maybe if your kid is older and they have access to social media, maybe they already know about it before you knew, from their friends, from whatever. Maybe they already knew.
How different do you think your conversations are as an African-American woman as opposed to a white woman who wants to have these conversations with her kids?
I think they're the same, right? In some ways, all families want their kids to experience safety, love, security, belonging, right? Feel respected. So in that way, the social emotional learning type of conversations are the same. The things that are a little bit different are, you know, when we talk about, well, statistically, how does this impact, you know, our community? I think it's important for a white mom to have that conversation and try to center, you know, like, what would a black mom have to say to her son or daughter, right? Like, you know, my daughters play lacrosse. So like, you know, their teammates are white and black. And, you know, so like, if you have people in your lives that are not the same race as you, right? If you're supportive of that person, if you're a teammate of that person, if you're a classmate of that person, a coworker of that person, you know, you have to think, how am I being, you know, an advocate for making their life better? What am I doing to support them? How am I trying to center what I know about race in America so that I may be a better coworker, friend, teammate, classmate to this person? So, you know, in many ways, we do want to have white moms, you know, not, you won't be able to completely understand. And I think, you know, standing in solidarity with someone does not require you to fully understand race in America or how someone is living or their experience, but you do want to have the empathy there to be able to connect with, I can see how this could impact this person in this way.
Now, Amber, you mentioned how you were watching some Snapchat videos with your daughter about everything that has happened over the last few days and this weekend. Peaceful protests, but then some ended up with police aggression, vandalism, looting. How did you separate these two very different issues for kids who might just see them as one thing that happened this weekend?
As we were sitting there together, and I definitely, you know, encourage families who their children are old enough to do so, you know, to look at protests from the perspective of the individuals who are down there, right? So we compared stories. In some places, the stories were extremely peaceful. people were on the side of the road. They had their signs. Cars were, you know, honking and driving by in solidarity. People were cheering. People were singing, right? In some places, the police joined in with the protesters and were standing together in solidarity. You know, we saw that on Snap Stories. You know, and then obviously in other Snap Stories, we saw more violence, which my, you know, my children were like, oh my God, like, what is this? Like, why is it like this? What's most important is to allow your child to process and ask them questions about what are the differences that you see, right? We want children to grow up to be critical thinkers. We want them to analyze the media that they consume. So that would be the first thing, right? And then the second thing is, you know, understanding how a protest can go from being peaceful and then moving into something that is violent, something that it was not intended to be, right? We all are in scenarios in our life where something starts off great and then, you know, oh my goodness, it just took a wrong turn. You know, how do we bring it back? How do we pull people together? How do we send a message that, you know, maybe this is not what we're trying to accomplish?
Talking to Amber Coleman-Mortley. She's the director of social engagement at iCivics. So then, Amber, then so in the micro, what happened this weekend is one thing. But in the macro, the larger issues of race and policing in America, how do we even begin to talk with kids about that? Because that could take months, years, decades to really hash out this conversation. And with kids, they grow up.
I think the most important thing is for parents to become an avid reader in anti-racist theory, ideology, and practice, right? There's a lot of books. You can even Google search, you know, how do I become an anti-racist? And this is for not just white families, non-Black families of color, and even Black families, right? If you want to make this better, if you want to have these conversations with your kids, read them with your family, right? Have a book club with your family. I would also encourage, like, history and civics are extremely important in changing the course and direction of where we are going as a country. You know, I tell my children all the time, when the Constitution was signed, our ancestors were considered, you know, 3/5 value of a white male, right? We need to contextualize and be able to grapple with the complexities of history and tell full, complete stories. And then also tell narratives that are overcoming, right? Like, we don't wanna focus on, when we're thinking about the long story of, like, race in America, we don't wanna always focus on the negative portions of it. We do wanna focus on how did individuals solve the problems that they were experiencing as communities or within their community? How did they use the Constitution to do that? How did they use the justice system? How did they use peaceful protests? How did they work together across cultural and cross racial groups to push the needle on equality and have America to stand up for the principles in which it's so beautifully has out here for us to actually actualize?
Amber Coleman-Mortley, mother and podcaster. Amber, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
All right, if you missed any part of Take Two today, a lot of great conversations, just head over to wherever you get your podcasts. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. We're also all over social media. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well, at amartinezla. That's at amartinezla. That's good for Twitter and Instagram. If you have any thoughts about anything going on over the last few days, please let us know there. Once again, at Take Two, at Take Two, at amartinezla. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.